Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Q Commentator and to episode 2 of series 3. My name's Nick Heath and it's great to have you joining me once again for what I think is another one of our truly honest and revealing conversations. But before I make my introduction, a moment to thank those of you that have been brilliant to leave a review on iTunes. It makes such a difference. It's also great to read as feedback on the interviews that I've done. Sarah Thomas said, love this podcast, ideal for any sports fan. Thanks, Sarah. I also hope to broaden to more sports in time. Ginger Dad, what a great pod. Been listening for a while and listened to all of the back episodes. Some really interesting insights into the people and the art of commentary. Favourite interview is the Ian Robertson one. Yes, Ian's live episode is a cracker if you've not heard it. A masterclass from the great Scotsman. Patrick Kendrick on John Champion in our last episode. What really marked John out was his awareness of the current landscape, having recently worked for many years as a freelancer. Love the insight into the cult of the commentator in the US too. Keep up the great work. Well, thank you so much, Patrick. We will have another guest on, intriguingly, who has moved to the US coming up at the end of the series. Another very well-established voice to look forward to. Those reviews are really valuable. Tapping the 5 stars, or as close to as possible, is lovely and magic. But if you can spare, a couple of minutes while you're listening, or when you've parked up, if you're driving along, to add a sentence or two in that review area, tell me perhaps which guests you've loved, who you'd really love to hear from. Please leave those reviews on iTunes. It's really appreciated. You can also message at Q Commentator on Twitter or me on at Nick Heath Sport with any other thoughts or feedback. And also hit that subscribe button. Many of you have. Lots of you are listening who haven't. It means you'll get the next episode magically in your inbox when it's ready. So do that. Now then, our guest for episode 2 of our third series is a trailblazer, a woman who just was the first woman to commentate on a football match on British Network Radio, and famously the first woman to commentate on Match of the Day. Now here's the thing, these are massively important lines in the sand, but if, like me, you think a lack of equality in any form, gender, race, sexuality, socioeconomic background, if you think it's embarrassing and disgraceful, then it can be tricky to work out how much to focus on these moments and kind of how much to move on and just be thankful that we are where we are now. By banging on about today's guest being the first woman to do this or that, it's kind of shining a light on something that should never have needed to be a thing. It's ridiculous that the profession of commentary was so male-dominated that a first woman moment only happened on something like Match of the Day 13 years ago. But they are moments, and they are part of someone's story. So I hope I cover these moments with the right level of sensitivity, and I apologise if at times it might sound like I have disdain for them. It's not disdain for the change, obviously. It's for the fact that the world was constructed in such a way that it contrived these moments to need to happen in the first place. I hope that makes sense anyway. I'm pleased to say that I managed to conduct this conversation for this episode in person. Oh, we managed a socially distanced setup in the garden and we enjoyed just over an hour's chat. And I think you'll find some fascinating stuff in here. How there were some real environmental challenges that, helped provide a sense of life experience. How adversity was something to overcome and use positively. And how working blimmin' hard alongside having the talent will get you there. I'm thrilled with this episode and the candour and the warmth I think you'll find comes across with it as well. It gives me great pleasure to have hand over to today's conversation and say Q commentator Jackie Oatley.
Hello, Nick.
Hello, Jackie. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Born in Wolverhampton, born and bred Wolves fan.
All right, okay.
clever lady, was a year ahead for most of her schooling.
Not clever, though. I don't know what happened there.
Okay, right. Well, got a degree in German at Leeds University, graduated at 21 after 4 years there. Worked her way around the world, did Jackie. Moved to London, got a job, and there you were. There was almost a path that was set out there, wasn't there? But while you're no doubt working and enjoying the London life, supporting Wolves up and down the country, playing football on Sundays yourself, there comes around a 27th birthday reflecting on being halfway up a ladder you weren't sure you wanted to be on, unhappy at work, a knee injury, 10 months on crutches. That's going to focus the mind a little bit. And Jackie did some research, tooled herself up for a new career, didn't you?
I did. Very well summarised, actually. I'd probably have told you that in about 35 minutes. So you've done very, very well to spare everyone that detail. But yeah, so it was a journey, in inverted commas. I tried not to use that word, and I've gone straight in with that. That it was maybe different to many other people, that it wasn't a case of growing up and wanting to be a football commentator. In a million years, it was never, ever like that. Not that I didn't want to, just that my surroundings, the culture of the time, it was never, ever something that I felt I could do at all. And so, therefore, I followed a slightly reluctant path of taking each step and seeing where that led to, rather than actually planning that situation. So doing a German degree because I could speak German already, I thought it would be 4 years, fairly straightforward. How wrong I was.
How's your German now?
Yeah, okay, this is nicht so gut, aber yeah. Exactly.
I can't speak German, so I can't reply. French I'm fine, but good.
No way. So each step I took, thinking, well, hopefully this will lead to something really interesting, and it really didn't, especially when I ended up working in central London and in an office all by myself because my boss was in his office in Devon. And I thought, this is quite what I had in mind. Intellectual property, account management, going to see all the local clients in the Chancery Lane, Holborn kind of area. And had nobody...
Sorry, I'm just falling asleep there.
Actually fascinating. Trademark protection and etc. And no, that wasn't really what I wanted to do. But it's one of those situations where, like so many of my friends, you get a degree and then you hope that something will come up that you fall into that's really, really interesting. And it didn't work out that way.
No. And so you went off to the bright lights of working out what your career might be beyond that and doing a bit of hospital radio, as I say, tooling yourself up by doing a training in journalism and radio production courses, shadowing wherever you could. Why did you decide that was going to be the career? Where did that drop into your head as a way you wanted to go? How did that happen?
So I think it had gradually built up on me that I thought it would be incredible to work in sports broadcasting, but I didn't have any inner belief. I didn't have any particular confidence I could do this. I didn't know anybody that worked in radio, which was something I'd love to do. So it wasn't one of those where you've got a family member or a neighbour or somebody who says, oh, you know, my great uncle works at so-and-so, come in for a day and have a look. And then you sort of work out from there that that's what you want to do. It was really very, very much from afar.
And was visibility part of that? Because I know speaking to Sarah Orchard, you know, her side of it was, well, there weren't women doing it, so I didn't think that a woman could do it.
Certainly not commentary. There wasn't anybody like that. So you'd see female sport presenters, but again, I didn't look at it and think, oh, I could do that. Nor did I really think I wanted to do that, to be completely honest. I had no interest in television. It was just the broadcasting, local radio. I'd grown up listening to BBC WM and I'd grown up recording a little mixtape on my cassette recorder, pressing play and record, and they'd go around the Albion and the Walsall and the Aston Villa, etc. reporters, and then they'd say they'd be going off to wherever. And as soon as I'd hear the name of the ground where Wolves were playing, if I wasn't there, obviously, then I would press pause, and that would play the recorder, or that would record, and I'd set up a little mixtape of the reporters' reports and do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. It's a goal. That was the goal klaxon, was my Pavlov's dog moment, yeah, where I got an adrenaline rush, and usually it'd be for the opposition because we were in the Championship or Division 2 as it was for ever and ever and ever. Yeah, it was sort of Division 1 for a bit, wasn't it? But it was, I always had that interest, but I just never had somebody say to me, well, you should do that, you could do that, or, you know, you're good at languages, which was something that came naturally to me, and sports knowledge, football was my complete obsession, not just Wolves by any stretch, everything, every team, every division, every player. I read Match Shoot 90 minutes cover to cover, including all the team lists and the substitutes at the back of everything, and I studied it all like a proper teenage girl weirdo. And but again, just didn't believe. So it was really, it took me to my 27th birthday to go, okay, I don't want to be doing intellectual property anymore. I can't play football anymore because of this horrendous knee injury I had. And I just thought, I'm so unhappy in my job, I have to do something about it. And I just thought, well, I'm going to research. And thank goodness for the internet, because it meant I didn't need to know anybody as such. And it was way before Twitter. This was 2002. And so I researched, read biographies, researched more, read more biographies, signed up for hospital radio, signed up for evening courses, etc. And after 6 months of that, thought, yep, this is definitely what I want to do, but I need to jump ship completely from intellectual property. I need to throw myself completely at this. I need to do full-time work experience. I need to see people. I need to go to press conferences. I need to go to anywhere who'll let me in and work out the next step. And the next step was a full-time postgrad, because I wanted to do it properly. I didn't want to... It sounds ridiculous, but I didn't want to get lucky. I didn't want to be in the right place at the right time with the far post to tap it in from a yard. It sounds nuts, because you have to get in however you can. And I'm not saying I would have said no had an opportunity come up, of course not, but I did want to learn how to be really good at the job and know all the do's and don'ts, and how to ask open questions, and how to record, and how to edit, and how to make my mistakes on a restricted service license station rather than on national television, for example.
Yeah, there is that. Yeah, and so the postgrad, you know, came up in Sheffield, and then BBC Radio Leeds. I mean, on your journey on the way there, not to ask too many personal questions about your bank balance, but were you saving up then towards the end of that job, going, hold on a minute, I might need a few quid in the bank here to be able to afford to take this reset, this change? Because I know for a lot of people, if they're contemplating that, that becomes a big consideration.
Absolutely. So as soon as I started working, proper job, if you like, in intellectual property, in when I was 23, straight away I started saving just by default, because I always had it in the back of my mind. I don't know what I might want to do one day, or the rainy day. We weren't thinking coronavirus, were we? You didn't think that would happen. But no. I think commentators probably wish that they'd maybe saved a little bit more for now. But yeah, so I saved up, and I thought, well, it's always going to be useful having savings for whatever reason. So thank goodness I was sensible. So when I decided to make the change, I did have some savings in the bank that I would have put towards a deposit to buy a flat at some stage. And instead, I ended up spending £11,000 on doing a postgrad and supporting myself, and petrol from Sheffield to Leeds and all around anywhere that would have me. So I supported myself and didn't get into debt or anything.
And by the time you're then working at Radio Leeds as a sports reporter, after the postgrad, you'd had the experience at that stage behind the mic in, you know, what you were training and some of the shadowing and the work that you'd been doing, I guess. So was there an element of feeling experienced at that point?
I felt as though my life experience was really useful, really useful, because I think a lot of people graduate at the age of 21, maybe do a postgrad straight away, and then at 22 they're like, right, where's a job coming from? I'll apply for this and hopefully get it, and then you're in wherever you may be, stop commentators, you're in local radio. And I just felt that having lived in Germany on my own as a student from the age of 19 to 20 and had some very challenging times there. I had a flatmate with some personal problems, which was very, very difficult to deal with. And having to stand on my own two feet for the first time away from my best friends. I'd gone to university with my best friend at the age of 17, so I never really had to stand on my own two feet. And then also travelling around the world with another friend from the age of 21, 22, and working halfway around. And brilliant, brilliant life experience. Absolutely fantastic. And then working in an industry where, in my second job in intellectual property, I was promoted in a very difficult situation above people who took it very badly, shall we say, and made my life a living hell. It was absolutely awful. and I was so miserable. But what a brilliant experience to have to deal with that. Mm. And I think when it comes to journalism, you need to have some guts. You need to be able to pick up the phone and cold call people and ask them questions that they might not want to answer. Or you need to build contacts, of course you do, in local radio initially. And that's what I did when I made the West Yorkshire non-league football scene my patch, whilst on my postgrad course initially and then afterwards. Mm. And I felt that just having been around the block a bit, having done various jobs and lived a bit and had quite a lot of adversity actually, rather than having life sort of mapped out for you and quite straightforward and comfortable.
Yeah.
I've been through difficult times and had to work out a way through it, and I felt that's really helped me.
You'd earned it.
For what lay ahead. I didn't know at that point what sort of scrutiny might lie ahead.
Well, indeed, and we will get to that. We will cover that a little. But was there any element then, despite those things that sort of, as I say, maybe felt you earned the right to be experienced and have all that behind you, was there any imposter syndrome that of you doing it?
Imposter syndrome is an interesting one because I did feel different for fairly obvious reasons, but I also felt I belonged because I knew I had the knowledge and the work ethic.
Good.
And I didn't feel like, oh, someone's going to catch me out here.
Yeah.
I didn't feel that because I had done...
Well, you'd put the work in to make sure that wasn't going to be the case,
absolutely,
hadn't you?
Absolutely, right from the very bottom, from hospital radio writing, from evening courses, learning introduction to print journalism on a Thursday night every week for 6 months, and radio production courses before doing my 1 year postgrad and shadowing as well. So I felt I'd taken every single step I possibly could, and then local radio, non-league football. And then having, of course, been on the terraces for years and years and years and studied for years and years, all these magazines and newspapers and articles and watched everything and listened to everything.
Fabulous.
So I didn't feel like
fabulous
somebody had
shadow.
Just said, oh, you've got blonde hair, do you want to go on the television and talk about football?
Yeah.
Not that that's possible to do, by the way. But I didn't feel an imposter in that regard. No, I felt very much like, I love this and I want to be here. And this little old studio at Radio Leeds, as it was back then, before they moved to some swanky new studios, I just loved everything about it. Mm. I loved the smell of the old BBC local radio studios. I loved the old microphones. I loved the fact that I had to phone round all these tiny little clubs in the northern counties.
Whatever league.
Northern counties, East League, etc. Glasshoughton Welfare, etc. And you didn't have social media back then, and so
no.
You had to, and it wasn't on the wires either. So I had to phone around all the, and it was really stressful on a Saturday, having to phone around and try and get all these results, and then read them out on my little 10-15 minute slot every Saturday, which I'd spent about 2 days prepping for.
Yeah,
and getting a guest on.
Amazing.
That I prayed would pick up the phone afterwards. So no, I didn't feel an imposter, but I did feel I really wanted to do it properly. I wanted to do a good job, and I just threw everything at it. Social life out the window, love life out the window, didn't care. My friends understood, my soon-to-be ex-boyfriend understood, and that was it. I didn't think about anything else for a few years.
You had an opportunity then to do your first commentary, I believe, according to my research, Wakefield and Emily versus Worksop Town.
Yes.
Obviously, I've heard you say in another interview, which I'll reference, which is a great chat for anyone who wants to see it, which is the 90-minute football chat that you did on YouTube. You mentioned within that interview that part of what was motivating you to get into the side of Five Live and sport and radio broadcasting was you liked the side of asking questions.
Oh, yes.
And so that doesn't necessarily translate into doing commentary, because commentary isn't necessarily about asking questions. So why and how did that come into play?
Because I was in Radio Leeds. I was initially, well, I was always freelance. I've always been freelance. But I was going in to do the non-league. And while I was still on my postgrad, and then afterwards when people were on holiday, I was filling in for people and doing various shifts there. And it became clear that people would start doing bulletins. And at Radio Leeds, we used to do the sports bulletins for Radio Sheffield, Leeds, York and Humberside around the clock.
Of course.
Which was brilliant training for me coming in, because I was writing, rewriting, and I'm a real stickler for grammar. So I loved the writing, rewriting, and really wanted to read it before I had to read it on air, because I wanted to make sure everything was perfect. I can't bear saying less people instead of fewer or that kind of thing.
Okay.
So I love doing that. And then I just saw people go from sports bulletins to match reporting to commentary as a fairly well-trodden path. And I just couldn't understand why, if I was in that room, in the sports room, which was a very welcoming place with Derm Tanner and Tanya Arnold and James Staten and Oggy and Popey, really, really good people who were very encouraging, very welcoming. I can't see why would I not want to do commentary or not ask to do commentary. And I don't know whether they'd have asked if I hadn't said, can I do commentary? But certainly they didn't say no.
Yeah.
And that's what you want, really. So I thought, well, I'll give it a go. It doesn't mean that I'll be any good, for goodness sake. But I felt I owed it to myself to have a go because it made no sense to stop. So I did say to Derm Tanner, who was the sports editor at the time, if I get a chance or if anything comes up, could I please make that next step after match reporting to commentary? And an opportunity came up, and as it often does, it's because something else has fallen by the wayside and suddenly you're in, you know, a match has been called off and Wakefield and Emily versus Worksop Town was suddenly the match of choice on Radio Leeds that night. And oh my gosh, I don't think I've ever been so nervous in my life.
How well prepped were you to see it coming? I mean, you seem to me like quite a thorough person in terms of the way you prepared for this new career. So I imagine at that point, you're listening to what you can of other commentators, knowing your gig's coming up, to make sure that you've got the right things in place.
Yeah, very thorough. We're talking a day after QPR Fulham, and I think I did an entire day's prep, and I was on air about three times for about 20 seconds, which is probably a bit ridiculous, but it's not wasted. It'll still be in my memory bank, and it'll still be on my computer. So I like to have all bases covered, but on that particular day, I'd done the sports news on Radio Leeds that morning, so I'd been up since 3:30. Oh. And in those days, you didn't get a lot of information about non-league football on the internet. It really wasn't that well developed back then at all, whereas now you've got inside leg measurements of the fifth-tier players. So that was very difficult, and we had to make sure that I had a summariser, and the captain was injured at the time, so he agreed to come on, but the commentary position was horrendous, and I just have one snapshot memory in the file in my brain of the pitch being miles away to our right, us being very low down, all the players being the same height with short dark hair, not be able to see numbers very well. And the hardest thing is, probably any other commentators who might be listening to this or aspiring ones, is to put a name on the ball. If you can put a name on the ball, then the rest just goes and you can fill it in. And with radio commentary, you can paint pictures, describe the weather, your position, patterns of play, ask questions at the summariser. It all becomes quite natural. If you can't put a name on the ball, yes, you develop techniques to get around it. But for your very first one, it's so hard because you don't want to constantly say, and the ball goes out 30 yards to the far left-hand side. He cuts inside, whips at it. You know, you don't want to constantly blag it. You want to know who's playing on the left wing, who's playing right back, and so you can put a name on the ball. So the first one was definitely the hardest.
Yeah. How do you think it went?
Oh, brilliantly. No, I remember it being blinking hard, really hard, for that reason.
Yeah.
For that reason, because the identification, the short notice. I mean, when I've done commentary since, I go to great lengths to memorise names and numbers. When I've done World Cups, Euros, it came up on Facebook the other day, actually, a year to the day since I did the Women's World Cup commentaries in France and the Thailand women's national team, but it felt like they were at least eight-syllabled names each, and I got my
good luck with that.
Then eight-year-old daughter to test me on numbers and names, and I found it so much easier to know who was on anyone in the squad before I got to that tournament. I'd already memorised all the names and numbers, and anything else was more straightforward after that once you had the name on the ball.
Yeah, that's very good. I should say, by the way, I forgot to mention in my introduction, we are gloriously in Jackie's garden here in Surrey, so you may get the wind blowing across the microphone occasionally just to set the scene. It's a bit of a showery today, but we're hoping to dodge the showers, and you may hear the occasional car go past in the distance, but that's live broadcasting for you as we are. So Jackie, joining then, I'm going to jump a little bit, but obviously you're getting to grips with then commentating and having that experience, and you get the opportunity to join BBC Five Live in 2003. You must have been like a kid in a sweet shop at that point. And you then go on to become the first woman to commentate on a football match on British Network Radio in 2005, covering the Women's Internationals in the 2005 UEFA Women's Championship. all of that must have felt pretty good.
It did. It did. I was so excited because women's football was getting a bit of a spotlight. Because when I first commentated, obviously it was men's football. And back in those days, in the early 2000s, women's football was an absolute joke in this country in the eyes of many people. Not just in the eyes of men, by the way. I mean, when you compare the attitude towards the women's game now compared to then, and I would say across the board, I don't want to drop anybody in it, but it was a battle to get people to take it seriously and to allow you to even talk about it on the airwaves. It really was because, well, partly in fairness to them, the standard was nowhere near what it is now because they'd never been given the opportunity, the support, the coaching, the infrastructure, the chance to play as a kid. I mean, it's pretty obvious if none of us had a football team to play for when we were kids and we were never given a ball, we were given Barbie dolls instead. It's not a surprise, is it?
Yes.
So that for me was a wonderful opportunity, the fact that Five Live were going for it with this tournament. It was based in the northwest of England, and I was going to be commentating for them. Hugely nervous, did way too much prep, way too much. Didn't sleep enough the night before. Oh, all the mistakes. Didn't sleep enough the night before. Didn't print off my notes until the next morning, which didn't then work. And then I had to go to the ground to get them printed off. All these things that you live and learn. And we do things differently as we go on. But it was an absolute privilege. And it was just good to get the first one out of the way because I did feel the weight of the world on my shoulders.
Yeah.
Even though it was radio, which is very different to TV and way less pressure.
And were you enjoying, you know, seeing Radio 5 Live on your pass and all these kind of things? I mean, it had been obviously a station that you'd been listening to and had headphones in for years, so the opportunity to finally be part of that institution.
I can't tell you what it meant to me to work for 5 Live. And even now, doing Game Last Night, I still listen to the jingle and get a tingle, and that rhymes. Honestly, it's...
tingle from the jingle.
I do, honestly. It's just such a wonderful station, and the sport, well, I used to listen to it wall to wall when I was single and lived on my own. I'd always have Five Live on all day anyway. But I think, very, very special. I think when I did my first broadcast doing late night sports bulletins or weekend breakfast, it might have been, I did that for 6 months. It just felt very special going into the studio with presenters who I listened to all the time anyway. So, and I think that stayed with me all this time, right up until now. And I include last night's QPR Fulham in that. And whatever I'm doing, whether it's Sky or whether it's ITV or whether it's anything at all, I just feel so lucky and so privileged to do this job and to be asked to go and watch sport. And I don't think that'll ever leave me because I wanted to do it so much, and maybe because it didn't fall into my lap and I had to work and work and work, as probably everybody's had to do. I just really, really value each time someone phones me up and says, can you do Watford Norwich next Tuesday? And I say, yes, please, I'd love to. I'd never go, oh, I've got to work next Tuesday. I was going to have a night doing this and that. Yeah. I still say yes, please, with relish.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. And it's funny, I went through sort of 10, 20 years of having the tightest, closest group of friends ever that I know I'll have for the rest of my life. But if someone says to me, I've got a game I need you to commentate on, I love them, but I'll drop them like a stone because, yeah, it's the excitement of being given the opportunity and being the person to be there. I certainly share that with you. In terms of then being a few years into it and being able to commentate on you know, women's championships like that and being appointed by Five Live, how would you describe your voice and your commentary? How do you think you were doing?
Ooh.
Yeah, there's a question.
What, do you know what? It's the first time I've been asked a different question on commentary. My voice. I don't think I've particularly changed my voice over the years, but we are always told to listen back. Mm-hmm. And if I've heard something that I think, no, too high, that goal call, no, then I'll absolutely do something about it. That's why it is important that you listen back, because if you're struggling to listen to it, then think how the poor listeners are. So I don't subscribe to the notion that, well, you just have to be yourself and that's it. No, if you do something that is slightly difficult to listen to or doesn't sound natural, I mean, you have to sound natural. I think that's the worst thing. If somebody sounds like they're trying to be a commentator, that's the worst thing you can do. So you do you do have to find your own voice, cliche though that sounds. It has to be a combination of being yourself, which is why I enjoy radio commentary particularly, although last year's Women's World Cup was just the most fun I've ever had, even though I didn't have a summariser or a presenter or anything. Did the whole thing from pre-match, half-time, post-match, everything all by myself. But I loved it. I think because I was so much more comfortable in my own skin after all these years compared to at first, when you do feel as though you're really under so much pressure and scrutiny, as I did, rightly or wrongly. And so, yeah, I think people, I guess, would listen on the basis that you're a female, and then they would judge other commentators on the basis of their gender too, which is completely insane. This is one thing I don't like, because if people don't like the sound of my voice, absolutely no problem whatsoever. But don't then go saying, oh, women commentators, just because you don't like me. That is completely bonkers. Just like if you don't like one commentator in Match of the Day, you don't say, oh, male commentators, they're all terrible. I mean, it's just...
Yeah.
Oh, and it's started to pour down with
it
rain.
It has started to rain. There's a fairly dark cloud up there, so we can consider taking a hiatus, depending on how much heavier it gets. I'm going to ask. I'll ask another question. We'll see how we go. I mean, related to that, though, I was going to say you could have people like Jonathan Pearce or other commentators that are capable of hitting quite high registers, which could grate on you just as much as a female commentator that might have a high register. You don't naturally have a particularly high pitched voice. Some women do, some men do. You know, so it has always. I found it quite interesting that people will hone in on the fact that. Well, it's because it's a woman. She's very screechy. It's like, well, actually, there are plenty of blokes out there that are commentating that I could tell you that are just as screechy.
Yeah, I do agree with that. There are some commentators who have a higher register and some have a lower. And we all have our own ears. We all have our own opinions when we hear something, as if, oh, that's a bit tricky to listen to. But I do think, you know, the elephant in the room is there's no point in being a high-pitched, screechy female commentator or male commentator. Mm. But that will be an issue because people really won't be able to listen to it. And that's not being prejudiced. That is just, if it's difficult to listen to, you won't get bookings.
Full stop, yeah.
Yeah, so there's no point in having a female commentator. If they start like this and then they get to the edge of the box and, oh, my God,
yeah.
Because people will switch off. So, yeah. But that does apply if you're a male as well. So... I don't think you'd really get to that level if you were super high-pitched. I think you do have to have a lower register, like the likes of Robin Cowan does, Vicky Sparks. I think if they were high-pitched, I don't think they'd get work, being completely honest, but I think the same would be said of anybody.
Yeah. Have you ever consciously had to think, lower it, get down there?
Oh, I've consciously thought about goal calls, absolutely, because I think if you... As a female in particular, if you say too many words during a goal call, I think that can be too much. So I think on occasions, maybe we need to minimise the wording, as you could say for a male as well, because you don't always want so many words over a goal. You just want to pause and enjoy it, depending on whether it's radio or TV, of course. They're very different media. But I think certainly if it's TV, you don't need to be all over it with too many words. And I think that's a way that women can... moderate the way we commentate is to use fewer words with a goal call, and definitely don't start too high because then it leaves you with nowhere to go. And you don't want to give people the excuse to go, oh, female commentators. You want to make it as easy for people to listen to as possible. And so,
but it's interesting, we clearly are still at a point, given the way you talk about it, and I agree with you, you're having to operate with an awareness that there's that voice, female commentators, just waiting for the opportunity to kind of jump on that. And it's a pressure that male commentators don't have to deal with. And I'm getting on this soapbox for you, but it's frustrating that's still the case, or that it's something that you have to be overly aware of, I think.
It is frustrating on the basis that we don't choose our gender.
Quite.
And I'm actually quite happy being female, funnily enough.
Yeah.
But at the same time...
You do it well.
But at the same time, I do also understand, as a listener to commentaries... and a watcher of television, I and nobody else wants anybody to be too high-pitched and screechy. I mean, it's okay to say that, so it's not a problem. So, yes, we all as commentators need to make sure that when listening back, oh, that was too loud, we have to make sure that we commentate as well as we possibly can, ideally use as few words as possible, nail the moment, and that can take practice.
Yeah.
Years and years of practice, of listening back and making sure that you nail that commentary. So when people listen to it, it's an enjoyable experience rather than going, ah, female commentator. Of course, you don't always want to talk about the fact you're female, but equally, there's no point in denying it. And there's also no point in pretending that everybody's equal and has equal opportunities and are not scrutinised more, because we are. So let's just get over it, talk about it, deal with it, and debate it if you like. But hopefully, ultimately, do a good job so that when people are watching, they don't say, oh, it's a female. And they just think of you as being a commentator because you're good enough at your job, which you should be anyway.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, a lot of this conversation comes to the moment in 2007, obviously, where Jackie fantastically was the first female commentator in the history of Match of the Day. I'm aware from listening to that great interview with Ben on 90 Minute Football, Jackie goes into great detail there, so I do encourage you to seek it out if you've got the opportunity. But the papers got hold of it happening, that you were going to be on Match of the Day that weekend, didn't they? And you were fairly hounded and messaged by people over the course of that week, it's fair to say, to the point that it kind of became a real distraction from being able to do the prep. And you've spoken about this, and do go and listen to where Jackie kind of outlines a bit more of it. But those distractions kind of got to you being able to do what you would rather have done, which was your best work.
That was my problem with it. I was a journalist, so I fully understood that being the first female to do something was noteworthy, because there aren't too many achievements, if you like, left that females haven't achieved. So I do understand the interest, but what I struggled with was the fact that it became a massive sexism storm, and should this one be allowed to commentate? And I did think that was absurd. But my biggest beef was, I mean, let people go and have these debates. They were having phone-ins on TV, radio, and that's fine, let them do that. But my issue with myself was the fact that I allowed myself to be drawn into that debate by politely replying to everybody who'd asked me for an interview, because of course I knew a lot of people in media from local radio stations around the country, from newspapers, because I've been in so many press box over the years.
Yeah.
So,
and you want to help people out because people have helped you out before, or that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I just wanted to be polite, and I phoned them back, I texted them back, and people were so kind the way they phoned. Lots of commentators phoned, and they were absolutely lovely. So that was wonderful, but with hindsight I should have left all that to the following Monday, pick up the phone and go, phew, thank goodness that's over, thanks for your call last week,
or
thanks for asking for the interview, I hope you understand why I didn't do it. But hey, we live and learn. And so yes, it became a big distraction in the sense that I didn't get much prep done at all, and what I'd planned to do that week before was listen to the various Match of the Days I had recorded on Sky Plus and really focus on the differences between radio and TV, because this was my first ever TV highlights commentary, which is completely different to doing live radio commentary when you're throwing to racing and you're throwing to the cricket and the darts and you're what have you, and have a summariser with you, and you're setting the scene, painting the picture, describing where the ball is, what the weather's doing. It's completely different to doing highlights commentary. So you are commentating for 90 minutes, but you don't have a summariser, and you're really more interpreting what's going on rather than just constantly putting name on the ball and saying where it is, etc. So that's something I really wanted to get into my head that week and study.
And conscious of the edit as well, it's fair to say, because you know that if a goal's been scored, you need to get that line out and finish it rather than leave a long hanging, you know, 15-second sentence that's well, what a goal, which is so good because in the week he talked about this. No, that's not going to work for the edit. It's a great goal, his third of the season, and it puts them back on par. Cool, that's the perfect length for the edit and we can crack on. And to want to be conscious of all that and on form is exactly where you want to be. Having your mind full of the week you'd had is not helpful.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
So that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to phone up an editor at the BBC to say, right, what do you like in a commentator edit-wise? What helps you out in the edit? All those kind of things, that sort of research, because I'm so big on research. So I'd wanted to have nailed my prep earlier on in that week, ideally most of it, and then spoken to coaches from either side, etc., to have every base covered and then to focus on the difference in the media. And it just didn't happen. And I'm not bleating about it now, because absolute privilege to be asked to do a game, contrary to popular misconception at the time. It wasn't a job. I was freelance. I was asked to do a game, having done them every week for Five Live and Five Live Sports Extra. So,
but I think it's important to cover it in this way, because I think, you know, one of my favourite films is Anchorman, right? And as parody as that is, the moment Veronica Corningstone nails reading the news is a big moment for her, and she gets the opportunity to nail read it. She's like, I nailed it, and it's hilarious and brilliant. But similarly, you don't want to have that opportunity, and as a result of things out of your control, feel like you weren't able to do your very best. And I think that's really relevant.
Yeah, that was the hardest thing for me. I just kept focusing on just do a good job, and then come Saturday night, Sunday morning, Monday morning, whoever says whatever, it's entirely up to them. But as long as I'm happy, I've done my best. So I did my best in the circumstances, but that was hugely frustrating that it came to very late night Friday night. And I remember phoning Mark Crossley, and he was like, oh, what a week. And I was like, because I'd commentated with Mark before, top lad, and he was at Fulham at the time.
Yeah.
And so he helped me out with sort of rough team news and, you know, bits and bobs, and it that was a frustrating thing. I should have been tucked up way before that. I should have had my prep done way before that, but that's how it was. That's life. And no, it wasn't my best commentary ever, and it was okay. It's life. It was a life experience. It was completely bonkers. I wouldn't wish it on anybody, but it's a life experience. And you take these and you stick them in the bank, the experience bank, and you move on. And my next commentary at Anfield for Match of the Day was go and do a commentary. And the photographers at the side of the pitch were focusing on Robbie Fowler's last match rather than the fact that there was a bird in the commentary box.
Yeah. And so it should be, my goodness. Well, I'm pleased to say, obviously, you've gone on to do plenty more commentating alongside reporting and presenting. I mean, interesting, you know, as you say, we're doing this chat during the COVID-19 period. I mean, I know you were single at the time, living on your own when that happened as well. So knowing how people have struggled during lockdown to be able to keep themselves on the straight and narrow, to have had all that going on while you were also on your own must have been quite a challenge. And it's to your credit that you look at these as being so good as a positive part of the fabric of where you've gone on to. In terms of the way your commentary has developed and how you approach games now, how much is there a routine? Where does your prep fit in? How do you approach match day? Just clue me into to Jackie the commentator as you approach a game these days.
Yeah, my life's quite random now. It's a mixture of presenting, reporting, and commentating on the likes of the Women's World Cup last year, which was, I mentioned earlier, my most fun time I think I've had in terms of the actual commentary box, which is strange for me because I've always enjoyed being part of a team, which is why I actually ended up moving into TV by accident, away from radio. Not intentionally, it's just opportunities came up. But I love working with other people, and it can be quite a lonely existence as a commentator, particularly away on these major tournaments, where the year before I'd been working as part of the ITV presenting team in Russia, and you're hanging out with Roy Keane and Gary Neville and Marty O'Neill and Wrighty. Just brilliant, brilliant, brilliant time, but totally different when you're preparing to present compared to commentate. So the following year, I was in the commentary box in Rennes for 7 matches for the Women's World Cup. barely saw a soul.
Yeah.
Barely saw anybody. And I was in this tiny little box for 3.5 weeks, missing my kids like mad.
Oh, I bet.
Because it was just me and commentary. And I am really square, as I mentioned, when it comes to notes and preparation. And I just spent far too much time doing that rather than doing what John Champion does, which is doing a commentary and then going out and seeing the local culture. I did a bit of that, tried to go to different cafes, get my nice sunglasses nicked. I spent so much time on my own, I'd have to do it differently next time. But the actual commentary I loved, because I think it was it 17, 18 years worth of experience, all culminating in the fact that I'm just more comfortable in my own skin now, whether I am presenting or reporting or commentating or doing the darts or whatever I may be. I just don't feel that people are staring at me anymore or listening going, oh my God, it's a woman. And it might sound daft to somebody who's not experienced that, but the early years, and that is years plural, I really did struggle with confidence. And I think it really comes through on air. I certainly did in some of my early commentaries if I, you know, was having a bad time of it or what have you. Whereas now, I think in that tournament, I was away from my young kids, which does help on the prep front. Much as I adore them, it's very hard when they're coming in every 2 minutes. Mommy! And just absolutely loved the fact that I could go into all manner of detail, but not just the names and numbers, as I mentioned to you before.
Yeah.
That's really the basis of it. But I love the stories. And as a journalist, I love doing the research and going to the press conferences the day before at the stadium and sort of chasing the press officer down the tunnel because you weren't supposed to go down there. And
yeah.
If I was nice to them, they kind of let me go a bit further than I was supposed to, and trying to get background information on players. And that really brought it to life for me. And then I really enjoyed doing the commentary based on, yes, the nuts and bolts of who's playing in which position and how many caps and experience. But I really tried to tell stories during the commentary about one of them was there with her. She had a toddler, 2-year-old back home. Another one had a 10-year-old or something. I mean, it was fascinating. And I think women's football can be really interesting in that regard because you do have so many different stories about how they got to that position and what full-time job they're holding down at the same time in the local supermarket while scoring a fabulous volley from 20 yards or something in the World Cup. How's that work? I think over the years, my prep has evolved. I use a template, which I've shared with up-and-coming commentators in case that's any help to them, because it took me a long time.
Are you a handwriter?
No, not a chance. If you want me to scribble down a note, you'll understand. I look at when commentators put on social media, here are my notes for today, I'm like, wow, your handwriting's neat.
Yeah.
I could not do that. I do everything on computer and then shrink the font and put in all different colours.
Either I'm speaking to, you know, older generation commentators, which a lot of our guests have been on Q Commentator, but the majority are handwriters. So to find someone else who is happy on a computer, I'm with you on that.
And
my hand had hurt.
I just couldn't. No way. I'm just too messy and couldn't get as much onto a page. And then I used to have too many pages of notes. And you can't find anything. So, no, I have a document saved in Word called Blank Template, funnily enough. And then every time I do either a reporting game or a commentary, I save as. And I have the only difference between the two is on the commentary one is an extra page for extra details for the players.
Yeah.
I still put that on a match reporting, but it's maybe not quite as fulsome. And then I know if I'm commentating, I know exactly where to glance to for, say, I have a section on talking points, you know, in case there's an injury and you just want to bring something out of the blue.
Mm-hmm.
And I have results, fixtures, goals, last liner, manager's information, quotes, head-to-head. All those things in the same place every time.
Nice.
And in different colours, etc. So I just know, you know, if there's a quiet moment and I need to sort of glance down at a stat, I know exactly where on the page it's going to be.
Yeah.
But with it being on computer, it means it's in a much smaller, neater font than it would be if it was handwritten.
You can fit more on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the prep in terms of the written detail. What about anything else you will do for the instrument of your voice?
Yeah, so I think you do have to be warmed up. I remember last summer doing Chile against Sweden, which was, we had this random thunderstorm, lightning storm, completely out of the blue. And I was commentating live around the world for the world feed. But the BBC had also picked up that feed because they don't necessarily send commentators to every game.
Yep.
So they were broadcasting that one. and suddenly we had something like a 40-minute hiatus. And I filled for most of that time, but I was having an absolute whale of a time. And I remember saying before that game, I just was in a particularly good mood that day. And I just started singing Wind Beneath My Wings around the stadium. And I tweeted this, that I'd warming up my voice by singing Wind Beneath My Wings, just hoping there wasn't anybody around the corner thinking, oh, dude, shut up, love, can't stand Bette Midler.
Can you hold a tune?
No.
No?
No.
But you enjoy it, clearly.
Yes.
Okay.
Nobody else does.
Okay.
Well, I think I can. My husband thinks I can't, so we'll have to beg to differ on that. But so it would normally be in a car on the way to a game, and then trying not to have too many milky drinks is another thing. Chocolate doesn't work well because it's not nice when you hear a broadcaster close to a microphone and they've just had some Galaxy and you could actually hear a... It sounds terrible to talk about it, but you just know and you think, oh, did you have to eat that in the break just then? Because you can hear it for the next 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Galaxy melting in the back of the throat.
Yeah.
It's not helpful.
No, it's horrible.
But yeah, I'd always notice when, particularly in my early days, if I got stressed out about commentary and be sort of doing too much prep or thinking about it overnight the night before, or you know, memorising names and positions in bed and thinking, oh, I need to take my mind off it, that the next day my throat would be tight and sore.
Okay.
So through experience, I learned to make sure I had my prep done earlier and just through experience again. And it did happen. I did feel that scrutiny as well at that time, but it's quite nice that that's subsided now, because then I don't have to spend the night before memorising names and numbers.
And so a bit of a sing-song in the car then, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, nothing too spectacular, but I did have singing lessons when I was younger, and I did learn a few ways to warm up the voice. So I think you do have to a certain extent. And of course, the worrying thing is you just don't want to lose your voice. And doing commentaries at World Cups, I did 2010 World Cup for Five Live. I think I did 7 commentaries in 7 different cities in 7 days. And my main memory of that was the lack of Wi-Fi. It was horrendous. The lack of time to update my notes I'd done before I'd gone. But yeah, you've got to stay fit and healthy. That's a really important thing. And stress can be terrible for the voice.
Yeah.
So you do have to... You want to socialise, you want to go out. But I'm not, unfortunately, the type of commentator who can... Who can have a large one the night before and then be on it the next day. I'm really quite square when I go to tournaments. Even now, darts tournaments.
It's a job,
everyone
though,
else
isn't it?
Is having a great time, and I tend to leave it to the last night. But that's...
Yeah. Hey. Well, that's certainly been a theme, as we've discussed with various people, and it's important. It is. You're looking after the instrument so that you can do the job. I mean, has it ever let you down? Have you had moments where you've struggled with it?
We've all had sore throats, but nothing too major that I can think of. Mm. I think that's the one thing that you just don't want to get ill, you don't want to feel sick. But I think probably that first Match of the Day commentary was the one time when I was just bent double in agony from having a knotted stomach from not having slept for 3 nights or eaten for 3 days. So fair to say that wasn't the best preparation at all, but never mind, that's in the past.
Indeed. And what about if you're, when you're within a commentary, we all strive for the perfect commentary and we all learn to realise that perhaps it doesn't exist. How do you cope with moments that you know within a commentary haven't gone particularly well? How have you learned to deal with those as you've got more experience?
Yeah, that's a horrible feeling if you feel you haven't done something well, or I don't know,
miss ID on a goal or anything like that. Any of these sorts of things happened, and how have you dealt with them?
I think you learn over the years to deal with it, because it's live. I think you just have to front up. You have to just say it was so-and-so who got the final touch, but particularly from corners. I mean, just in the last couple of days watching games where you think it's impossible to know who scored until sort of 10 seconds later. So you learn coping strategies for that. And if you're not sure, you really shouldn't just hit and hope, if you like, because afterwards you're like, oh no, it's not ideal. But I think the worst thing is if you're looking down at a moment when, you know, a ball struck from 20 yards and you weren't expecting it, that's the worst thing. So
yeah.
I think, again, over the year, this is an experience thing. I think so much of it is experience, that you've done something, you think, oh, I'm not doing that again. I'm just going to make sure that if the ball, unless Charlie Adams on the ball from 60 yards, then you know not to look down at your notes because he might just ping one in. But ideally, you've got to just have as much in your head as possible. That's something that I've learnt over the years, the number of times I've spent days on prep, particularly in the early days, and having these beautifully manicured notes with everything colour-coded and different fonts and different sizes. And it comes to the commentary, and you just haven't got time to look down.
Yeah.
And you spend all these days finding out this fabulous information that you think is really interesting. And because it's not in your head, you don't get to use much of it. So, again, that's another
thing it's a security blanket to a degree as well, isn't it? But then maybe you realise that you need to put less time into that.
Yeah, and everyone has their own way of doing it. And my boss at Five Live always told me off, Matthew Allen, always said, stop doing so much prep, stop doing so much prep. And I didn't really know what he meant. And I did do too much prep. But at the same time, it is about doing the right type of prep. Because I would do every player, this sounds ridiculous now, I would do every single squad player's height initially. And ages, but I'd say age 22 until August, so that next time I did that team, I would then be able to update it rather than doing everything from scratch, because I might do them again a couple of weeks later and think, well, they might have had a birthday since then. Whereas if I put 22 until August, then I can...
I'm nicking that. I've not been intelligent enough to put that in mind, of course. But then, you know, Nick Mullins said to me, he's like, oh, I can see you're putting heights, ages and weights in your... in your prep sheet. We did a little comparison several years ago, and I've probably said this on the pod before, but he was like, it's quite a Bill McLaren thing to do, you know, or the 6'6" guy who's all of 27 years or whatever. And he's just like, unless they're 17
exactly.
or they're 40,
yeah.
everyone's a professional athlete between the ages of 18 and 35. So just...
Exactly. So if it's Adebayo Akinfenwa, then his weight, if you have it, particularly compared to his strike partner, for example, and he might be 5'5" and, you know, 9 stone. That's interesting because people know him as being a...
Didn't know Willie Carson was a footballer? I need to update my jockey references.
So,
really,
but I'm interested in those kind of things. But again, that comes from experience. And initially, I had this ridiculous comfort blanket of everyone being 5'7" or 6'1". It's totally irrelevant. But I remember, you know, that first Match of the Day commentary, Zat Knight was 6'6" in the danger area or whatever. That's relevant.
It is,
he's 6'6" and he's gone up for a corner from the back. So yes, that's relevant. But you do learn what you're likely to use. And there's certain stats I couldn't care less about. You know, it's his 50th appearance for Barnsley. I mean, really, who cares? I mean, honestly, you get these in the stats packs and notes. And no, I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in if his wife's gone into labour this morning and he's, you know, hoping to be back in time or...
just playing with a sense of urgency.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more into the, yes, of course, the relevant stats. You know, if it's his 100th goal for the club, of course it's relevant. But I do try to bring people to life a little bit more and talk about the colour and the background and the stories behind why they're here. Or this might be his last game because he's been linked with a move to his join his brother at
wherever.
Norwich or where, whatever it might be. So, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Who did you emulate? Obviously, you were listening to a lot of voices through Five Live, as you mentioned, as you grew up. But who've been the sort of sporting voices that you've rated over the years?
Oh, how long have you got? Honestly, I think you've interviewed most of them in this podcast.
I may have done.
You have John Champion being your last one is just somebody I admire so much for all sorts of reasons. I mean, when he was part of our team at ITV for the last Men's World Cup, he and Ali McCoist were just such a wonderful combination. They were so easy to listen to. They brought even the most diabolical game to life. And I think that dynamic is important because you can sometimes tell if there's a little bit of tension between the commentator and summarise, or even if it's not tension, just the lack of chemistry. So I think when you get a combination like that, a bit like Steve Bull and Andy Mutch, you know, it really works. I think that's been picked up elsewhere now. So,
yeah.
But John Champion for ticking every single box, the voice, the brevity, the not using too many words, the context, the colour, the likability, everything. Peter Drury, another lovely man. Both of them I rang up actually before I went to the Women's World Cup last summer and said, look, you know, really want to do a good job on this tournament and you've been to so many of these, you know, talk me through some of your sort of top tips, and made loads of notes. I've still got them in the books upstairs because I think the two of them are just the best at those tournaments because they are different to just going to a commentary on a Saturday or a Tuesday.
There's a longer narrative, isn't there?
Yeah, and you know, about life in your hotel room. And
yeah,
I didn't do what Peter Drury told me to do, which is make sure I got out enough, but hey ho.
There you go.
Yeah, so I would say those two. Peter Drury, for his use of vocabulary and language, he's just wonderful at that. all the Five Live lot, I would say, pretty much. You know, John Murray, Ian Dennis. I think Ian Dennis, because of his contacts in the game, he knows so many people that he sounds like he's phoned up 15 people before each commentary, so he knows more than most people. He's not somebody who's just sat in a hotel room and got the stats and gone to a game. None of them are. They all, I think the ones you know who've spoken to people in the game, that makes a difference.
Yeah.
Match of the day lots, guy, oh, gosh, so many.
They're all
Rob
there.
Hawthorne.
They're all there, yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I struggle to think of somebody who I really can't listen to. I mean, everybody has the favourites, but I can't. I think most people would probably name one or two, but no, I admire everybody for different reasons. Mm. Like I said, Peter Drury for his use of vocab, but.
That's good. And what about
Simon Brotherton's voice, for example? It's just so easy.
Yeah.
The big moments.
Yeah.
It's so easy to listen to, and he nails those big moments very well.
Yeah.
Guy Mowbray, of course.
What about co-coms? Why do you think the best of them are the best?
When they've done their research. Yeah. I love a summariser who has spoken to people in the game. And this is where I think some of the new pundits straight out of football find it a little bit difficult because, yes, they want to get information, but they don't want to drop their mate in it or you know who they are. But somebody like Danny Higginbotham, I would point to as being, having carved out a fantastic punditry career. You could argue not one of the biggest names in terms of the box office names, but his experience of fighting Premier League relegation battles is every bit as valuable as somebody who scored 200 goals in their career.
Yeah, okay.
Because you need that angle as well.
Yeah.
And the fact that he speaks to somebody, so when I've worked with him at ITV and done FA Youth Cup matches with him, for example, he's always spoken to people, you know, chatting before games, said, oh, I've spoken to Moisey or somebody in the week and he said this, and this player's going to be great because of this particular characteristic. And especially when doing those types of games, you really do want to know about the player and, you know, and what they're like as a character.
And great for you as a lead com to be able to hear what that is in the lead up to a game so that you can open the door for your co-com to bring this info they've got into the commentary.
Yeah, and again, you don't want them to be doing your job and saying what's happening, but they, the good ones, know that. And if they haven't done much of it, then you tell them. Again, it's different for TV and radio, but you just say to them, you know, I'll do the nuts and bolts and you analyse the systems, analyse which teams are playing well and why, and bring back to the view. But I've certainly done not too many, but I've certainly done a few commentaries over the years, and the summariser's shown up, basically said, right, who's playing, what game is it?
Yes, I've had that.
And your heart sinks because you've just spent, in my case, a couple of days doing prep for this commentary, and I've literally had to tell them everything about the players, about
and as a girl who likes to do her hard work, how do you like it when they go, can I have a look at your notes?
No, I would happily share them with them because you're a team and you want you want the commentary to be good. So I'd spend the hour before the game telling them stuff. But that's not the ideal situation. And no. I remember going to the World Cup in South Africa and being really impressed by Martin Keogh. And we were in, I forget which particular media tent it was, Bloemfontein, was it, I think. And he was going around meeting foreign commentators and asking them about their teams and you know, the team that we were about to do, and that was good. Somebody who's not afraid to go and get that information rather than sort of sit there and rely on their reputation or saying what they see, or Farpo should have done better. And I think the game's changed now. I think the punditry game's changed. You can't just be a big name now who plays golf during the week and who shows up on a Saturday and says, oh, he'll be disappointed with that, or three defeats in a row, manager's looking over his shoulder.
Yeah,
that's not enough now. And I think you'll see the best pundits around. Yes, some of them are big names, but whether they're big names or not big names, they tend to know their stuff and have to do their own research now. And that's, I think, how the punditry games have changed. And certainly with co-coms and summarisers, they have to be in the modern world and they have to know these players or know these managers and study form and have watched the games at the weekend to be able to reference it, and they have to work hard now.
Yeah, they do. I don't want to keep you too much longer, Jackie, just a few more questions if I may. You mentioned obviously the TV and radio differences. Many of our guests have touched on what they believe the main differences are. Whether we're hearing the same thing or not, what do you find are the key things to think about?
well, if you're doing radio, you're obviously painting pictures, the weather, the temperature. I mean, not too much on that, but setting the scene. Somebody like Conor McNamara, by the way, is brilliant at that. He's so, so
absolutely,
good.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the Five Live lot in general of the setting a scene, I think, are fantastic. And the nuts and bolts of remembering to explain to listeners, which way players play. You know, there's different ways of saying on the left back over the far side. Okay, so you know that they're attacking the goal away to your right. Or you can say Liverpool attacking the goal away to your right. There are different, or attacking the goal, whichever way you want to describe it. There are different ways of saying it. But for TV, it is very, very different. It's not usually something that people have to think about straight away. People don't tend to go into TV commentary. Although with a lot of betting websites now, there is more work off tube, of course, which is a very different experience.
Yeah.
So it is more a case of analysing what you see, whether it's a bad tackle or not. You don't have to nail your colours to the mast, but you have to be a bit stronger with an opinion than you would be maybe for radio, and you can leave it entirely up to your summariser. And I think you have to put a goal into context better.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Fewer words, and you have to capture the moment, because your goal on TV could be played back many, many times. Say it's a World Cup, Women's World Cup, whatever it might be, whatever the sport. And if it's played back 10 years later, you want your words over that moment to really capture what happened and put it into context.
And so how aware are you of that as that goal's being scored?
Yeah, you have to be. I think it has to be a mindset that you train yourself, that this is a World Cup and this goal could be played back. And it's more of a mindset you go into the game, so that you know if there's a big moment that you want to get that moment right. And you might pause. You might allow the ball to hit the back of the net, make a comment, maybe put a name on the ball, and then give it a couple of seconds, allow the crowd to go up, allow the crowd to go down again for a moment, and then give it a few words. Contextualising it rather than just talking all over it, and that's a great goal from 30 yards on, that's wonderful, and we'll be playing that for years to come.
And yeah, and will you write a note or a line or two in any of your prep so that it's a World Cup final, it is a goal that needs context that might be attached to a few more things than you would be able to bring to your mind in the moment? Will you prep any, not necessarily lines, but
I think you think about them, definitely. It makes sense to be aware of them, because you don't want to finish a commentary and go, oh my gosh, that goal was so significant because of X, Y, and Z, and I didn't mention it at the time. So as part of your prep, definitely you prep for the context of if it's a player against the former club, or you might have a line in your mind, but I certainly wouldn't sort of sit there with a load of different lines written down in front of me, because you can't go, hang on a minute, hang on, which one is it? Kane, hang on, what have I got for Kane? And Kane has just...
Yeah.
So no,
I'd
that doesn't work.
That.
But certainly in your mind it makes sense to just prep. If a certain player does something, then you have that in the back of your mind of what the significance of that moment is, and make sure you capture it.
Which do you prefer, TV or radio?
That's really interesting. I love the teamwork of radio, having a summariser, being a bit more natural. I enjoy more natural broadcasting than something that's more formulaic. So Match of the Day is a bit more formulaic in that regard, because you have to bring to life those clips, really, those moments. So I prefer the sort of slightly chattier nature of commentary, radio commentary, and having a summariser who you can have a bit of fun with. I like to have a bit of a laugh. But yeah, TV's fun as well, and you are working as part of a team, a bigger team behind the scenes, the cameramen and the sound people and the director and the producer. So I've always been more of a radio person in that regard, in terms of commentary. But you know, I really admire the likes of, you know, when I sit next to Clive Tilsley and Glenn Hoddle doing the big games at World Cups, and you know, I'm still in awe of how Clive picks exactly the right words for the right moments. And I think a lot of experience helps, but he still does it very well.
Yeah. 2020, then, a senior, become the host of Sunday Supplement on Sky Sports Now. Belated congrats. I wondered, out of the commentating, presenting and reporting, where do you feel happiest now?
That's a great question. It's really weird, because my career is really quite random. I'm not in one particular box. if I was phoned up and asked to do a commentary next week, I'd absolutely love to do that. But equally, presenting TV shows, I love the question. I love the Sunday supplement opportunity to ask questions for 10, 15 minutes and to let it breathe, which is really unusual in television. Really unusual. I mean, radio, you tend to get longer to chat, say Monday night club type things, or the Friday night preview of the weekend's games tends to be a more relaxed format where you can do that, but not so much on TV. So it's a brilliant show for that. I love doing Sunday supplement.
You're allowed to love them equally if that's where we're going.
Yeah, probably less so the match report. I do enjoy the match reporting as well, but I love to really get stuck into something. And with Sunday supplement, I work really, really hard during the week in terms of notes and picking up quotes and watching everything and listening. I do way too much prep for that. way too much prep.
Finding a running
and doing a match on a Saturday and then get home and kiss the kids. No, Jamie, you put the kids to bed. I'm back to do more prep until late and then up at 4 o'clock in the morning for Sunday supplement. And
nice.
At my desk at six, reading all the papers. So I'm looking forward to hopefully going back to that, but we'll see.
Yeah.
Not too sure at the moment. That is... I'm not really giving you a straight answer, am I?
It's fine. It's fine. I'll take it. On the commentary front then, what would be a couple of pieces of advice you might give to someone looking to become a commentator or to perhaps improve?
In terms of looking to become a commentator, you have to be really sure it's what you want to do, because there are so many people who want to commentate, and relatively speaking, there are so few, not even jobs. I mean, it's not really a job, is it? It's a lot of us tend to be freelance and wait to be asked, and if you have a contract, then great, or jobs are very, very few and far between. So you have to really want it, and you have to be prepared to work extremely hard. And if you don't want to work every weekend, well, maybe it's not for you. You do hear along the way people who still want to be able to go to weddings, birthday parties, hang out with their mates a lot of weekends, and they want to be a football commentator. And in 3 months of Sunday supplement, I missed three friends' 40th birthday parties because they're on Saturday nights and I was tucked up in bed. And so if you still want to be able to do those things, it's very difficult to really make it as a commentator, I'd say, when your work is weekends, evenings, etc. And I would say work extremely hard. I would say listen to podcasts like this, the likes of John Champion. Hooray! And John Murray. I wish these
is the right answer.
I wish these podcasts had been going when I was starting out, and which you didn't really hear people talk about. You read the very odd article of somebody who's made it to the very top. But I would say work hard, ask for advice, and commentate into mum or dad's iPhone and listen back. And if you can, get some feedback on it from somebody who's done it and who has a good ear for these things, because you have to listen back, improve, cut words out, cut the clichés. Way too much.
Hear your patterns.
Oh, way too many clichés going on. And people, again, because people listen and maybe listen to the adverts and think that's how you should do it. So
Yeah, understood. Yeah,
and just try to improve. And in terms of trying to get up the ladder, just work extremely hard, be nice to people. Take every opportunity. If it means missing your best friend's birthday party because you've been asked to shadow somebody, well, that's up to you, isn't it? But the commitment has to be there.
Finally then, Jackie, there will be a time when the day comes where you may be approaching your last gig, your last match, your last moment in the Q Commentator Fantasy Final commentary. It could be a week, it could be a weekend, it could be a tournament, single game. What would be the sort of job you'd be happy to call your last? Which, obviously, we hope is many, many years away. But what do you think that might be?
Over the years, I've tried to hide my footballing allegiance. And it was very easy for a number of years until social media and presenting a podcast as I do for Wolverhampton Wanderers. So I think if I'm going to give you an honest answer, it would have to be Wolverhampton Wanderers winning the Champions League final.
There we go. That would be quite the occasion, wouldn't it? Amazing. Well, Jackie, look, you have definitely proved yourself in the greatest way to be probably one of the biggest swats I've spoken to of Q commentator. It has served you well, the work you've put in. You've been a trailblazer. You've been incredibly dedicated, and it's really testament to the hard work that you've put in that you've earned the accolades and the work that you've continued to get. Long may that continue. Thank you so much for your time. Jackie Oatley, all the best for the future.
Thank you, Nick. It's been a pleasure.
So I hope you didn't mind the odd car and van trucking past there. It was so good to be back recording an interview face to face. It really was. There are a few more coming in this series that have been recorded virtually, but I'm grateful for Jackie letting me come over to her house and her very neat garden as well. I hope you enjoyed that as well. I thought Jackie was great. Clearly someone who works her socks off, maybe overworking on the prep at times. It was interesting, if not a touch sad or frustrating, to hear that it's the scrutiny that ends up putting good people off their stride rather than letting them get on with being great at what they do. We heard more backing for being square and getting the job done, not going out mid-tournament to save the voice. We also heard Jackie praise Q commentator as a resource for commentators. So she's read the script on that one beautifully, clearly. My thanks to you for listening. My immense thanks to Jackie for her time. It's at Q commentator on Twitter, and please do leave a few words on iTunes for me. I will be your best friend. Tennis is on the cards for next time. Until then, take care, and I'll catch you soon. Bye for now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.